Good day and welcome to Our Blue Ocean, a weekly podcast by Brief, the Bahamas Reef Environment Educational Foundation. My name is Keyshawn Monroe, the co-chair of the Brief Board, and I am your guest host for today's special episode. Today my guest is Jason DeCares Taylor. For those of you who do not know, Brief would have installed the largest underwater sculpture, Ocean Atlas, back in 2015. It's a sculpture that you often see on commercials in the Bahamas and airport in those awesome photos. Jason is the sculptor of that remarkable piece and many others around the world. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, good morning.
We also have with us Ms. Jasmine Colley.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm the Outreach and Education Officer at Brief. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast this morning.
All right, thank you, Jasmine. So let's start with Jason. Please introduce yourself and share how you became involved in underwater sculpture.
Sure, so it's been quite a journey. I've been working for almost 20 years underwater primarily. I originally studied sculpture back in the UK, but I was very fortunate. In my younger days, I was used to teach scuba diving. I lived all over the world. My mother's from Guyana, and my father's from the UK. And we used to travel around, living in different places, such as Malaysia and Europe. And we were very fortunate to have a lot of sort of underwater experiences, going snorkeling from a very young age. And then from that, I sort of put together, my two different backgrounds of sculpture and, underwater diving, and started to think about the underwater world as a space for, artworks.
Nice. So what drew you to create art specifically connected to the ocean and conservation?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, being involved in the marine world for some time, I sort of encounter the same picture where wherever I go, everyone says, oh, this place was, heaven 50 years ago. It was full of fish. It was beautiful. And everywhere I go, everyone just talks about it degrading and becoming worse. So for me, I think that's also just, fundamental across the world at the moment. But, I really wanted the works to not only sort of, be there for their art's sake and for the conceptual message, and I also wanted them to have a practical purpose. So I found out at an early time that the works as being sited underwater, they could grow corals on them, they could provide habitat for marine species, fish, crustaceans. You could also tell very strong environmental messages with the works. But you could also control how people interact with the marine world. So you could draw people to areas where they would have lesser impact on natural environments or natural coral reefs. You could help areas become marine protected areas, which are really important. So for me, that was a really big turning point. It wasn't just an exhibition that I did on land and packed up and put in storage. It was something that that was eternal, that transformed, that evolved, and ultimately had a positive impact.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned those elements of your practice. It's eternal, and how in an earlier discussion I spoke about it being, in my opinion, art intervention, right? A lot of people use the term that you're being an activist, but I think that there is so much you could say about the permanence of your work, of your sculptures. I don't even know if I should call them sculptures, right? Because they were sculpted, but they have gone far beyond what we know sculptures as regular artworks to be because of the context of these places. But I'm curious, Jason, the artist. We know you as a sculptor, but where did you start? Were you ever a painter, a photographer? Because I see you taking photographs underwater as well. So could you give us a little bit more of how you, what was the natural progression into sculpture? And not just sculpture, but these grandiose, like, world record breaking creations?
Well, it's interesting, you know, I kind of now, you know, older, I can look back at my younger years, and I didn't have a very traditional path into sculpture. You know, a lot of artists, you know, go to university, graduate, sign up with a gallery, and you know, have quite a sort of set route. Whereas I left art college and went into lots of different types of job. You know, I was really keen to explore the world, really keen to do different things, and so afterwards, I did a lot of work in set design, building big stages with cranes and logistics. I did a lot of photography work, worked as a paparazzi for a little while. Prior to art college, I actually spent quite a few of my younger years being a graffiti artist, painting trains and walls. And I think all these experiences sort of come with it. And obviously the diving, you know, being a dive instructor, you know, fed into that. So all of them sort of culminated in this very bizarre career. And again, it wasn't something that, you know, I just sort of jumped into and like started. You know, I worked for 20 years. I think for the first 7 years, I barely got paid. So it was certainly been a sort of long process that's evolved. And and I still feel like I'm just at the beginning, because the ocean is vast. It's 2/3 of our planet. It's so untouched. Artistically speaking, in my mind, you know, we haven't really, you know, art for me is about exploration and about, you know, asking questions, seeking, you know, new spaces, new ideas, and you know, the underwater world has, you know, that in leaps and bounds. We hardly explored any of it. Artistically, light, color, atmosphere, your mental presence, everything is. You know, the laws are all changed.
It's literally the world's largest set.
definitely.
So you have to control the lighting. You have to wait for the right time of day to photograph. And I think it's very important, a lot of the points that you touch. I'm an educator, an art educator, and there are certain formulas that artists are usually taught to achieve quote-unquote success. It's very important that you noted that you pursued art at the tertiary level, but then you decided to get out. I don't like to use the word quit, right? So could you tell me why you decided to pursue it, and why did you decide, I don't think I'm going to pursue this any further?
I mean, I faced, you know, I was young and ambitious, and I think primarily, you know, I wanted to earn money after I left university. You know, I didn't want to be scraping around. I wanted to travel and do things. So, you know, like many artists, I went and found different employment. But, you know, sort of almost, you know, 15 years later, I always thought, I went with a plan that, you know what, I'm going to earn money and then do art free of any sort of commercial constraints. And I'm just going to do it, not as a hobby, but like with freedom. I didn't want to be doing it commercially. And so, but then I realized that my sort of life was ebbing away and actually, it was, you know, it was actually interesting. I went through a period where I had a plan to have a business, and I realized it wasn't viable, and all my plans sort of completely fell apart, and I'd been working for 5 years to this end goal, and it collapsed, and I sort of felt left with nothing. And from that, it gave me the freedom to think, you know what, I'm just going to stop trying to orchestrate things, and I'm just going to go with doing something that I love doing. And that was it. Yeah, that's how it sort of all began.
The risk. jumped off the cliff,
yes,
out of the
mess. Yeah.
Yeah. So another important point for persons interested in any particular venture in life where they feel as though it's going to be their life's work. Growing up, where exactly did you spend most of your time growing up? Because in the Bahamas, when I was growing up, art was not a very popular thing, because first things persons would ask is, how are you going to sustain yourself? How are you going to make money? So like, could you just give us a little bit more background on where you spent most of your time, what country, and what the mindset was regarding pursuing a career in the arts? Was it something that was celebrated and that you were encouraged to do, or was it more so like in other places, like in the Bahamas a few years ago, where it's like, okay, you good, you hard, but are you gonna live?
Right? I mean, I think, you know, that mindset is prevalent in many places. I think having an education in the UK was pretty fundamental for that. You know, I met, had some very influential teachers when I was at secondary school that were very passionate and very inspiring. I was also very fortunate that I had parents that also were very sort of open to, you know. But I also think that's changed. And, you know, I do think there's now much more pressure on people to, you know, I did a project recently where, I don't know, about 5 years ago, which was asking students for them to project their wishes for the next, you know, and those wishes we put into an archive and actually put them inside a sculpture that went underwater. Oh, and it was this kind of underwater archive of what people were thinking. And I was sort of amazed and saddened by just how many people came up with the same answers. And it was, I want to be a celebrity. I want to be rich.
Yeah.
I want to be a lawyer, or I want to be a doctor. And there are those four kind of categories. Mm. And I'd say probably 80% of the people, and I got them from different countries. And a lot of those were from the US, some from England, and some from Mexico. And actually the ones from Mexico were very different, and they were much more holistic and much more... ambitious in my mind, but it was quite interesting.
If I may chime in here, I noticed that you said something very important, how art and conservation have this amazing fusion. And I think it's so important how the sculptures have become our underwater classroom, and now we're exposing a whole new generation of students, of civil society, of tourists, a lot of our stakeholders, into like widening their mind, innovating, and bringing awareness to such meaningful conversations surrounding climate change, surrounding our resources, and how we can be better ocean stewards. So I just think that's such an important role, you know, having that level of exposure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And Jason, because I wanted to get a little bit more background information, because I think it's very important for our audience to understand where you're coming from, your context. Growing up in the UK, you could actually walk into a museum that's at least 100 years old. We don't have that luxury.
Mm-hmm.
I think our quote-unquote museum is a couple decades old, right? So it's very important to kind of share that unique perspective and the potential for certain things to exist on many different levels. Right. So what I want you to do, following up on Jasmine's comment, what I'd like for you to do is tell us a little bit more about the inspiration behind the sculpture, Ocean Atlas, that is at Clifton right now.
Mm-hmm. So Ocean Atlas was a piece that I made around 10 years ago. And again, you know, I was really interested in exploring new narratives and new, you know, scale of design. And so I've done a lot of works that were life size, that were placed sort of in, you know, different scatterings on the seafloor, in tours, in new multiple units. But I'd never done something that was truly monolithic. And I'd never done something that had gone from the seabed to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt strongly about sort of encouraging younger people to take more interest in the sea, to get involved in marine conservation, and so it was building on that Greek narrative of Atlas holding up the planet, and I wanted to do a young Bahamian person holding up the sea, stopping it from collapsing. So we had a young Bahamian model called Camilla, And she was a sort of inspiration for it. And the poses of her sort of crouching down, holding up the surface of the sea. And this, it was a huge challenge. You know, it was almost, 60 or 70 tons. It goes up, you know, almost 15, 16 feet high. And, you know, it's visible snorkeling, diving, glass bottom boats. And it's huge, and it's still to this day the Guinness Book of Records largest underwater sculpture in the world. Yeah. And it's still standing tall, you know, and it's been through hurricanes and all the various events of the last 10 years.
Yeah, and it is used for coral propagation as well.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting, you know, the effects, you know, the brief have been really amazing, and they've done a, you know, coral restoration program around it, populating the local reefs with coral fragments. You could also say that, you know, part of that park has helped create a marine protected area, which is, you know, really, really critical for all our coastlines. And thousands of people go and see it, you know, so yeah, right. I hope it's had a positive impact.
Yeah, it's very important.
I can definitely say it has a positive impact when the awe on the faces of the students when they look at Ocean Atlas. It's all, that's the number one topic they speak about. Even years later, interacting with the same students, they're like talking about it, and it's the inspiration for them to get into biology, to become biologists. So it has its impact. And like I said, with us having that coral restoration nursery right on adjacent and populating it widens the conversation, and it's really, your artwork has been the spark of many meaningful conversations and inspiration behind conservation.
Definitely, and we truly appreciate the relationship you have built with Brief. Speaking about Ocean Atlas, you put that particular piece down in 2015?
Yes. Okay. I think 14, actually.
2014. It's now 2025. And just recently, you put down a new sculpture. Could you introduce us to that sculpture and let us know what was the inspiration behind this new sculpture for the Reef Sculpture Garden?
Sure. So, I mean, since making Ocean Atlas, you know, I've been on quite a journey. I've made works in Australia, in the Maldives, in the Mediterranean, in ice waters in Oslo, in tidal areas in London, in the UK. And each project, I'm always trying to do something a little bit different. So this was a new project where I wanted to create two identical works and put them in two different locations, one on land and one underwater. So this new piece called Lady of Coral is also going to have another piece, Lady of the Land, and each one is going to be seeded with different species. So the underwater one hopefully will have marine environment with coral propagation and sponges and sea life, and then the land-based one will have terrestrial species. And so the idea is to sort of show how everything is interconnected, how, you know, events that happen on one side of the world affect, you know, the outcomes on the other side. So these two pieces across the Atlantic will have the same foundation, but will be shaped by their surroundings in different ways. And new piece, and I'm glad the installation went well, and I look forward to seeing it change.
Yeah, it's very much a very strong conceptual element to the work, conceptual and contextual. Could you describe the symbolism? I know you just spoke a little bit more about the message, but why this particular person, and why the pose? And I know there is text on the actual sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Is it positioned in a certain way for a reason?
Yeah, so it's actually a privately sponsored sculpture for a change. It's very different to my normal commissions. And this particular woman wanted to sort of be like a sort of a guardian of the reef. She's very involved in conservation programs. Mm-hmm. So she is sort of looking out over the coral reefs, over the nursery, and sort of acting as a guardian. And her pose is very sort of stoic and sort of overseeing. And also structurally, it's in a very shallow area, which is very susceptible to strong waves and undercurrents, and can easily move. So she has a dress that keeps her very grounded and almost in a kind of pyramid formation.
And it is facing Atlas, right?
Yes, it's facing Atlas.
So it's almost like a conversation, observation going on between.
Yes, and the idea is that you sort of approach her from her silhouette from the shore.
Yeah.
So you leave the snorkel tour on the shore, and again we wanted that extra work. One of the original works by a Bahamian artist, Andret, he's got covered in sand. Mm. As the sand levels change through various periods, he's got covered. So we wanted to also have something that when people approach the sculpture park from the beach, they also have a new work to explore.
So those who are listening, just for context, in the sculpture garden, there are pieces by two Bahamian sculptors, Andret John and Willis E. Tynes as well. Just so you are aware. So Jason, I know we spoke about the connection between Atlas and this new piece that you put down most recently. Is there any other way those two connect?
Not entirely. I mean, the idea is a sculpture park which has, you know, different artworks. Mm-hmm. There isn't a general theme to the whole area.
Okay.
So each work is sort of independent in its own right.
Okay. So we have spoken a lot about the, if we want to categorize it, we have orange economy, blue economy. Being artists or being an artist, I tend to use those because I don't usually like those titles. Speaking about the ocean and speaking about art, for me, is art intervention, art education, art activism, art awareness, I guess art, right? What do you believe the role is in art? What role do you believe art plays in raising awareness about marine issues?
For me, you know, over the years, you know, I've realized, obviously I'm an artist, I'm biased, but you know, I think it's, you know, a fundamental tool in shaping conservation and shaping our relationship to the planet. And I think at the core of everything is this separationist divergence from the natural world, and this kind of narrative that it's man versus nature, or we're here to conquer our environment, or to claim this land, or it's something that, you know, has happened for centuries, but not, and almost regressed in modern times. There are many groups that have lived in a much more symbiotic relationship with the natural world. But I do think it's something that, you know, we've become very separated from. And I think art plays a really important role in fostering a new connection. I think, you know, we are super emotional beings. You know, you look at all the big decisions we make in our life, you know, it's who we fall in love with, you know, where we live, where, you know, what we do. They're not things that are informed by statistics or science, or, you know, there's some elements of rational thinking to it, but a lot of it is done with your heart. Mm-hmm. And I think politicians know this, and I think advertising agencies know this, but I don't think in the science community it's well communicated. So I think, you know, art plays a really useful interface in changing that connection, making people fall in love with things, make people feel connected, emotional, and inspired. And you know, I've spent a long time sort of, you know, wanting to show people statistics and showing people, you know, this is, you know, everything's going to be dead in 50 years. And it hasn't worked. You know, you can talk about climate change, and we've known about it for ages. And we're just not you can't see the mass movement, but you see something like COVID that comes along, and everyone has fear instilled into them, and there's this huge shift, and everybody reacts overnight because there's fear and emotion attached to it. Whereas climate change feels divorced, and but is, you know, it's huge. It's our survival.
Yeah, and I think your work goes even deeper because you make statements. You spoke about your history and your experiences dealing with art in public spaces. A huge element of facing art in public spaces is safety, understanding the environment, crowd control, understanding flow, engineering, and putting anything underwater, not even underwater, next to salt water, is a lot of work just doing research to see if it'll last. Durability, we just spoke about the sculpture being known from 2014. We're still speaking about it today. We just saw it the other day, right? Not only has it lasted, but it has been encouraging growth, which is a change for most structures. You know, they usually get degraded. So what I would like for you to do to take us into that different level of understanding and appreciation for your work, what materials and design considerations go into creating a sculpture that lives underwater?
A lot. So again, that's been quite a long journey in working out exactly the right materials, the sort of engineering side of it, how it's going to deal, you know, here in the Caribbean with hurricanes that are becoming more frequent. Wave action, currents, safety of the people actually, you know, interacting with it. So there's been, also obviously the, you know, how it encourages marine life, you know, what are the textures, what are the formations, which creatures live at which level in the water column.
For those who aren't aware, these sculptures are made out of concrete, cement?
Yes, it's a type of, pH neutral concrete.
Yeah.
And they're all generally made on location, so I actually have a slight cold sweat when I look at Ocean Atlas because it was really difficult to make. We made it here in August, so it was blisteringly hot. And we had a very tight time frame, and I'd never done anything like it before, so it was problem solving every day in 40 degree heat. It was really and we had to assemble it all underwater because there's no crane that could lift that type of weight, so we had to build it in sections and then assemble it, which is very dependent on good weather and a good crane driver. And so it was, it was a huge challenge, and
Wow. Jasmine, you have any comments?
It's amazing, actually. And I also would like to say how the sculptures has been also, it lowers a lot of persons when they think about science, you know, they think only scientists, you have to be a PhD. Mm-hmm. But now having art infused with science, it also encouraged persons to it drops the bar on you being a scientist. Now we have a lot of citizen scientists who regularly go out and, you know, simply just being enjoying the area, they can, you know, report a coral bleaching, because like a few years ago, you know, when we had that mass underwater heat wave and a lot of corals, Ocean Atlas actually had corals growing on her which actually bleached, and that gave the message out a little bit quicker.
She turned white, didn't she?
Yes, like she did. So she had patches turn. And I think that's just so important. Now persons, you know, anybody can be a part of the conversation, be part of the science community, be a part of the art community, and, you know, and just have this community that feeds in to protecting our planet and protecting our oceans. And I think that's so amazing.
I mean, I often like to think of the works as like Trojan horses, where you sort of, the first reaction is, you know, spectacle and, you know, curiosity, and it's unusual and it draws people in. And then I think once people are engaged with it, then you can disseminate the messages of science and the, and some of the, you know, some of the background stories there. But it's that initial shock, which is so difficult now because we're subject to so many visual images, you know, that Yeah, I feel like it's a good way in.
So let me ask you, Jason, do you have a favorite moment from the installation process?
When it's finished and it's safely and safely in place, that's definitely, you know, I kind of always spend, you know, the previous week sort of replaying the sequence of events, you know, what's going to happen, you know, and there's still a lot of stuff out of your control, but you kind of play it through. So there's usually, yeah, just an immense relief that, you know, and it hasn't always been the case, you know, I've done a lot of projects where, yeah, weather's changed, you know, the things haven't cleared customs, we haven't had the permit, hasn't arrived in time, funding has changed, or, you know, there's always, you know, mountains to climb, but so it's, yeah, huge satisfaction when it's in place.
So let me ask you, I know as an artist, when I see my works, like even years later, they still feel like my children. Do you see your works as your children? Question one. Question two, when you see coral growing healthily on these children or your works, do you feel as they are also a part of your family, so to speak, or a part of something that you help to produce?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I do sort of use that analogy of children quite a lot because, okay, you know, in the studio, some of the works, you know, some of the projects are like 5 years long.
Oh.
They're all based on real people. So they're all either body casts or scans of people that I know and work with. And so, you know, and I live with them for quite a while. And I think about them all the time and invest a lot of energy into it. So that moment when you put them into the sea is that kind of like they've graduated or they've left home or they so yeah, and I have no more control of them over that. After that point, they're left to their own devices. So when I go back, no, definitely I'm always you know, humbled to see how they're changed and, you know, what a difference they've made. You know, when I go back to one of the big projects in Mexico, you know, it was a barren stretch of seabed with nothing there, and now I go back and there's thousands of corals, there's turtles, there's, you know, 10 different tiers of fish species that live within it.
Wow.
And there's hundreds of tourists that swim around in it, and it has had a, you know, huge impact.
Wow.
So yeah, no, really proud, but I'm also a bit OCD and a bit of a perfectionist, so I also go back and that's marred by me going, oh, I wish I'd changed that, or I wish I'd done that. So it's a bit of a
But I think you and your work does have a huge impact globally, internationally, and you should be very proud. We are proud of your work, we are proud of you, and we encourage you to continue to come to the Bahamas and check your children out and to have more interactions with Brief, our community here in the Bahamas. So on that note, Jason, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to getting out to the Brief Sculpture Garden and viewing those pieces firsthand.
I mean, one of the things I just would like to mention, that of all the different places I've worked, you know, this particular installation is the most accessible out of all. You know, it's just a short swim in clear, beautiful, warm water. It's one of the easiest you could ever, you know, go and visit. So I definitely encourage as many people as possible to go and take a look.
Yeah, and the visibility in the Bahamas is usually great. Okay, so if you would like more information about Brief and their programs, please email us at brief@brief.org or visit us on our website, brief.org. Or Brief 242, that's BREEF, the numbers 242, on all social media platforms. Thank you.